All right, welcome back to Arab Talk on KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM in San Francisco. Listen, we're very, very fortunate to have with us author Hadani Itamars. She's the author of Dancing in the No-Fly Zone. She's also the co-author at the New Internationalist magazine. And she recently came back from Iraq and wrote an article. It's called Iraq, 7 Years Later, The Legacy of Invasion. And Hadani, welcome to Arab Talk. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Shukran.
Shukran. Listen, you know all the hype on the media of what a success Iraq has been, and the invasion is over, and the troops are winding down, and you know the spin. You just got back. What was it like?
Well, I have to say that there are a lot of invasion apologists who are happy to say mission accomplished. But hardly anywhere does one find reports of the humanitarian disaster that is currently unfolding in Iraq. I was there at election time in March preparing our May issue of New Internationalist, which is actually called 7 Years Later, Iraq, 7 Years Later, The Legacy of Invasion, which I photographed and wrote. I actually did the whole Iraq theme in the issue, so it's more than one article. It's kind of a mini novella.
Uh-huh.
But it was my first time back there since I went in the wake of the invasion in 2003 when I was researching my book, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone. And, of course, I've been covering Iraq for The New York Times and other people since 1997. So I've seen the country at various stages and before and after various crises. And I have to say that, sadly, things are getting much worse for the Iraqi people. 70% of Iraqis do not have potable water. There is almost the same percentage unemployed. Things have gotten much worse for women, for gay people, for religious minorities. It's a post-secular society, which has been severely damaged by sectarian wars. It's a walled-off, broken city now, Baghdad, and it really saddened me to see that. But, you know, we have to look at what the legacy of this invasion is, that, you know, people should be asking questions like why, after $53 billion in quote-unquote aid, which mainly went to foreign military contractors and, you know, local officials and corrupt government officials, why 70% of Iraqis don't have potable water, why there's, you know, 43% of the population living now in abject poverty. And we have to look at this in the perspective, you know, of Iraq having been a highly educated, modern, secular, developed nation with the best public health care and education system in the Arab world, with the highest status of women in the Arab world just a few decades ago. So there's really been this ongoing onslaught against civil society, which really, you know, we have to look at, of course, the legacy not only of the invasion, but looking back the last two decades, the tragic 8-year war with Iran that wiped out an entire generation of young men on both sides, of course, but also bankrupted Iraq, and that was followed by 12 years of draconian UN sanctions and then followed by 7 years of occupation and invasion. So the Iraqi people have been through a lot. And when I read the news reports, the triumphalist ones saying mission accomplished, there's democracy now in Iraq, I feel a little ill, frankly.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you have to look at the spin behind this idea of having brought democracy to Iraq, because as far as I can tell from reading NGO reports, human rights reports, Amnesty International reports, Maliki is hardly a paragon of democratic virtue, and neither are many of his opponents. I don't know how we can call this a democracy when there are no real laws on campaign financing,
right,
when incumbents could use state funds to campaign for their own reelection, and when Maliki could arrest, detain, beat, and even execute his opponents on trumped-up terrorism charges. If that's democracy, you know.
I know. Maybe that's the American version of democracy for the Arab world, perhaps.
Well, it's, you know, I have to say that if you read the issue, you'll see that there's The last piece is sort of a political analysis. There's various kind of sections throughout the magazine. There's a cultural section. There's a section on women's issues. There's a section on health care. There's a very damning fact spread, a two-page fact spread with some rather sobering statistics. But, you know, you have to realize that this whole idea of democracy, you know, I mean, although it's farcical by certain standards, at the same time, I mean, there was a genuine enthusiasm from some Iraqis that I met. I mean, it seemed like everybody was running for office. You know, an old Sufi sheikh that I had met on a previous trip was running. A former journalist, a woman who'd written for Al Thawra and then went on to work for CNN and was now running as a candidate. Even the former conductor of the Iraqi National Orchestra was running.
Wow.
So, but, you know, whether they had a chance of winning was arguable because I found a lot of the old sort of artists that were running for the Communist Party, which seemed to be having kind of a minor comeback among young people and artists, because, of course, the Iraqi communists were purged in the early 70s under Saddam when he was the head of the intelligence ministry and actually got names provided by the CIA, a little help from the CIA.
Right.
He managed to purge, kill, you know, exile most of the communists. And then a lot of them actually came back, oddly enough, post-invasion to work for the Ministry of Culture. So there was this kind of interesting little neo-Iraqi communist resurgence, and there was oddly a nostalgia, well, really not that oddly, but, you know, Iraqis have nostalgia for various golden ages. When I was there in the wake of the invasion in 2003, people were looking to the monarchy, actually, as a time of stability.
Right.
Now it was more Qasim, Abdul Karim Qasim. And
right.
I remember, you know, he followed the monarchy, which was which ended rather violently, and then he was deposed, one could say, in a 1963 Ba'athist coup, which was backed by the CIA. He was flirting a bit too. He was a bit too friendly with the Russians, I suppose. But you know, I spoke to a man in his late 60s in Mansour Market and in Baghdad, in central Baghdad, and he said, "Yes, I remember that time well under Qasim." He said, "Oh, it was great." I said, "What was great about it?" And he said, "Well, there were jobs and there was security."
Wow.
Thought, well, that's not a lot. That's not a lot to ask for, jobs
no.
and security. But in Iraq today, those remain elusive. You know. So
we're speaking with author and photojournalist Hadani Itmars. She's the author of probably one of the most important books written on Iraq. It's called Dancing in the No-Fly Zone. We want to encourage our listeners to go to her website, which is www.hadaniitmars.com. That's H-A-D-A-N-I-I-T-M-A-R-S.
Wait, there's a D there that you're missing. It's Ditmars, D-I-T-M-A-R-S is my last name.
You know what I'm going to do for our intern here who gave me this information? Of course, we'll be fired. Iman?
No, that's fine.
No, I'm just
don't
kidding.
Worry.
So it's Hadani Ditmars. That's HadaniDitmars.com. If you get the book from her website, you'll get a signed copy. But I also want to encourage our listeners because, you know, what's really lacking right now, Hadani, is like an analysis and discussion of Iraq. We're not seeing it because Afghanistan and other issues are on the table, and the unintended consequences of Iraq are bound to have a huge impact on our foreign policy. And I'm encouraging our listeners to go to the New Internationalist, the latest edition, where you can read and find out actually what's happening in Iraq. We only have a few more minutes, Hadani. Can you give us a bit about the just a little hint, a little taste, a little maza, as we say in Arabic, on the political analysis from the New Internationalist. What's happening in Iraq right now?
Well, as I said, you know, I was there during the elections time, and of course, you know, over 2 months later, we still have this hung parliament, and no one really knows how it's going to end. There have been various developments. There have been changes almost every week. But I think, you know, no matter who wins this election, they're going to have a lot of work to do to address the basic human needs of the population when you have a fifth of the population that are internally displaced or refugees, when you have 43% living in abject poverty and, as I said, 70% without drinking water. Those are basic challenges, I think, that would test the mettle of any politician.
Right.
And in terms of the political power vacuum, I mean, there is a lot of, and you know, there's a lot of unease among my Iraqi friends. I'm still in touch with a lot of people by Skype, actually, because the phone lines are not great. And people are genuinely concerned about the opportunism, the political opportunism that will take place in this sort of political void, which has already happened, which is ongoing. We do hear a lot about the lack of security for foreigners, but for Iraqis, every day is a challenge. You know, just getting around Baghdad, getting from A to B, takes hours because you have to go through all these security checkpoints. You never know when there's going to be an IED that goes off. There's still a high level of militia violence, nothing as bad as 2006, 2007 at the height of the sectarian wars, but the potential for reignition of those sectarian wars is great, especially if the Sunni candidates or the Sunni community feels once again snubbed by the entire process, or worse than snubbed, really completely left out. Yeah. So that's a reality, but I think we just have to look at the backdrop of this humanitarian disaster that's unfolding there. And, you know, when you talk to, and I went to a clinic and hung out with women and children who are waiting for hours to see a doctor who had come from very remote areas where there were no clinics, and now they had to revert to this private clinic because the state hospital, you know, that had once been the best in the Arab world, actually the conditions there are worse than under sanctions. And I was asking them, well, who are you going to vote for? And they were like, look, we're not even going to vote. We don't even feel that our vote is going to make a difference, and whoever wins is going to be corrupt. And we're dealing with the daily struggle of, you know, not having electricity, not having water, trying to raise children in this kind of environment is a challenge, to say the least. So I think that really there's not going to be any kind of peace in Iraq until the basic human needs of the population are met.
That's the voice of Hadani Dittmar. She's the author of Dancing in the No-Fly Zone. Go to her website. It's hadanidittmars.com, HadaniDittmars. Also check out, she's the co-editor of the New Internationalist magazine. It's an amazing read, and we encourage our listeners to check both out. Hadani, thanks so much for your analysis. I'm sure we're going to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we'll see you soon. Okay, that wraps it up for another edition of Arab Talk here. Send us your comments to arabtalk@kpoo.com. And we're going to end with Nader Diak's strike in honor of the World Cup. See you next week.